This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In a new book with a provocative title, Avraham Burg, the former Speaker of the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, argues that Israelis and Jewish people around the world should stop living so much in the shadow of the Shoah, the Holocaust, that they should reevaluate the role the Holocaust and the collective memory of the Holocaust plays in politics, language, government policies, and in everyday lives. He describes what he calls the Shoah industry. We cling to the tragedy, he writes, and the tragedy becomes our justification for everything. We sit on the branch of past mourning, he continues, not taking off for the heights of humanity and humanism where we belong. The book, we told you it has a provocative title. It's called The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes. The author joins us in just a moment. Later, we'll also hear from one of his critics and from you. Is the Holocaust too much with us? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the hour, former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and former Secretary of State William Cohen, former Secretary of Defense, excuse me, William Cohen, join us to talk about a new report that urges the Obama administration to take a leading role in the prevention of genocide. But first, Avraham Burg joins us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you with us on Talk of the Nation today.
Thank you, Neil.
And you tell a story in your book to illustrate the grip that the Holocaust, or the Shoah, has on Israelis, a story about a man you call Mr. D, who goes on a business trip to Poland.
That's right. Mr. D is a colleague associate of mine that I wanted to make some kind of deal with him, part of my industrial life or business life. And we couldn't set up a meeting, so he said, I'm going to Poland. I have a 10-day trip or 2-week trip. I'll call you when I come back. 24 hours later, his secretary calls, you can see Mr. D tomorrow morning. I said, no problem. I came and said, where have you been? He said, I've been to Poland. And I said, why did you come back? You said 2 weeks. He said, I came to Poland. We touched down at Warsaw Airport. We took the train, and then we crossed the country, forest, trains, snow, conductors. I couldn't stand it anymore. It all came back to me. And I said, I made a U-turn and came back to Israel. I said, what do you mean all came back to you? He said, it was the Holocaust all over again. I couldn't stand it anymore. I wrote it down and went back home. In the evening when I sat down, I was in the middle of writing my book. I called him. I said, tell me, what do you mean it all came down to you? Where are you from? Where are your parents from? He said, they are from Iraq. And all of a sudden, you realize here is an Iraqi Jew who's coming from the Muslim hemisphere, miraculously so, did not suffer the horrors of the Holocaust, but he was consumed by the national psyche, and this was his.
There's another story you tell about how this is used in debate, large and small. In this case, an argument over budget cuts. I think you were at the time the head of the Jewish agency. And there was an argument over budget cuts for some of the youth groups sponsored by the Jewish agency.
You really read the book, didn't you? yes, and I said, listen, it's inefficient. We have to do this, we have to do that, because, you know, even larger organizations have to live by their budgets. And then somebody jumped at me, a right-wing revisionist jumped at me and said, how dare you cut the budget of this youth movement? They were the nucleus of rebellion in the Warsaw Ghetto. Without them, our entire national pride would have been... And what will you do if there will be a next Holocaust, a second Holocaust tomorrow morning? You must support these potential partisans, etc., etc., etc. And it goes all over the place. I mean, when you ask Bibi Netanyahu, what do you say about Ahmadinejad these days? He says, Ahmadinejad, it's 1938 all over again. And you say, is it? Did we have such an omnipotent army, 38? Did we have the entire Western superpowers behind us, 38? Did we have the Catholic Church changing its Nostra Aetate in 38? No, we did not. And why letting Hitler going so cheap at the price of Ahmadinejad? But it's there. It's the omnipresence realm of our life, and we must address it.
Bibi Netanyahu, also known as Benjamin Netanyahu, of course, the head of the Likud bloc.
And
quite possibly the next prime minister of Israel in elections that come up. But you talk about, we hear this a lot, the threat, the idea of a second Shoah, a second genocide, which you say in your book, Israel is not on the brink of a second Shoah, that in fact, most Jews around the world are better off than they've ever been.
We are a blessed generation. I mean, I take it if I could have had a conversation with my father or mother, and they would ask me, Avrum, what's going on? And I said, listen, Grandpa, we have a very powerful army, some of the best academias in the world. The high tech is leading in, I would have said NASDAQ, but you know, today I should choose some other criterions. And our reputation is not that bad. I even talked at the NPR this afternoon. I take it my grandpa would have said, what happened, Avrum? The Messiah arrived? I mean, from the point of view of all the previous generations, we are living in the best generation ever. And this has a factual base. The fact that the overwhelming majority of the Jews, 90-some percent, are living in the democratic hemisphere is an indication for a new existential reality. You cannot continue as if life is like it was in the last 2,000 years, because there is a turning point. And the turning point happened 60 years ago by the establishment of the State of Israel, 63 years ago by the opening of the gates of Auschwitz and the rest of the concentration camps. And we're living in a new era, and we must depart from the horrors of the past, slowly but surely, and move from trauma to trust.
This is not to argue that the gates to Yad Vashem, the great Holocaust Memorial Museum in Jerusalem, should be closed.
No, on the contrary. I mean, in order to move forward does not necessarily mean that you have to forget. On the contrary, I say, when you are so obsessed and over-remembering and overusing and cheapening the sacred memory of the ruin, of the destruction of the Holocaust, by the end of the day, you cannot make room for any future development. And even more than this, I look at my children, I say to myself that they will come, maybe in our lifetime, their lifetime, and they will live in the first day ever since that there will be no living witness. What will be then the reality of their life? Should we just cut paste or copy paste or clone the previous trauma and mold their future through the prism of Auschwitz only? Or do we have to give them other facilities or intellectual skills and moral and psychological dimensions to enable them to say, we remember, like we remember all of our history, because we are people of a long memory, and at the same time, marry again or get connected back to the eternal Jewish optimism, which just evaporated in the last couple of years.
And more on that in just a minute. I want to get some listeners into the conversation, too. 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Our guest, Avraham Burg, his book, The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes. But one more story, and that is about how you argue that the guilt for the Holocaust has been transferred in many Israelis' minds. You talk about a visit to a school in Jerusalem and a young boy who says, this is at the height of the Second Intifada, when people are being killed with some regularity, bombs going off, that sort of thing. And he says, the Arabs are worse than the Germans.
These Arabs, I mean, it's always these, you know, it's a kind of generalization. They're worse than the Germans. What they did to me, and we speak about the high days of the bloody 2000, 2001, 2002, that buses are exploding all over the city, and pizza parlors are a dangerous place for kids to go. And he was so angry, and he was so impacted by his personal horrors and traumas, and being a Jerusalemite kid there was a very difficult task. And for him, when the comparison came, the German memory was a fading memory, and there was a kind of a psychological transformation that we took the entire hatred and animosity and anger we should have had against our perpetrators, thanks a million, of the last generation, and imposed it and applied it on those we have today, which never will be the case. Never mind how bitter will be our Palestinian enemies. It is never something to be compared to whatever happened in Germany in Europe between 39 and 45. But still, in the minds of this kid, there is a kind of an equation between the Arab atrocities and the Nazis' crimes against our humanity.
The transfer of victimization.
Yeah.
And you also ask him, what kind of car does your mother drive? And he says,
I think, if I remember, you read the book after me, so you remember better, but I think my mom is a battered Volkswagen, my father on a new Audi or something like this. And here you have it. Germany is riding our roads. There are so many Israelis who love soccer teams in the Bundesliga and so many tourists in Berlin. And I was there just 6 weeks ago running the Berlin Marathon. You can't imagine how many Israelis ran alongside with me. So we have a kind of conciliation or reconciliation with the other Germany, not yet with the Arab world around us.
Let's get some callers in on the line. Let's start with David. David with us from West Windsor in New Jersey.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead, please.
My question is the following. As everyone knows, Israel engages in many actions which are very controversial. And in many cases, I think, rather than responding to charges, which are debatable one way or the other, Israel responds by charging that the people who are accusing it are threatening to submit Israel to a new Holocaust. And I wonder what the guest thinks, whether it thinks Israel is using that kind of response to shortcut debate, and if so, what his response is to that.
Thank you, David. The answer is yes, with no but. Somebody once told me that the difference between an American and Israeli is that American is saying yes, but, and Israeli is saying no, but. So here you have yes with no but. And this is at the very first years, early years of the State of Israel, where it was so fresh, the memories and the wounds, and the blood was still there, and the living witnesses walked among us. It was natural. It was only a normal reaction. Now that we are so many years later, you have a feeling that politicians are recycling and reusing and overusing this argument. It cannot be the arch explanation for everything. And in a way, when you compare everything to the absolute evilness, you create a kind of a permission. You say to yourself, and so many Israelis do, "Oh, Gaza is really awful. From a human point of view, it's really awful. It's not nice, but is it gas chambers?"
Is it Auschwitz?
So
yeah.
The answer is no. It's not a gas chamber. So it's okay, right? So I say, in real life, you do not compare relative realities to the absolute evilness. Remove it from the equation and leave the morality of real life.
David, thanks very much for the call. We'll talk more with Avraham Burg in just a moment. His book, The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from His Ashes. In just a moment, one of his critics will join us. 800-989-825 if you'd like to join the conversation. Stay with us. Neil Conan, Talk of the Nation, NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times last month, Avraham Burg argued, quote, "Israel must abandon the everything is Auschwitz in mentality. The way things are done today, the absolute monopoly and the dominance of the Shoah on every aspect of our lives transforms this holy memory into a ridiculous sacrilege and converts piercing pain into hollowness and kitsch." It's the argument he lays out in his book, titled The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes. Avraham Burg is former speaker of the Israeli Knesset, now a retired politician. Do you agree the Holocaust is too much a focus for our lives? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. There's also a conversation underway on our website, npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. Joining us now is Omer Bartov, the professor of European history at Brown University and an historian of genocide. He's with us today from a studio on the campus at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Nice to have you with us today.
Hello, good afternoon.
And I wanted to ask, is the Israel that Avraham Burg describes in the book the Israel that you know?
Well, it is and it isn't. I think, obviously, Israel is obsessed in some ways with the Holocaust. It's hardly surprising. The country had a population of just over 500,000 people at the end of the Israeli War of Independence in 1948, and many of the hundreds of thousands who joined it came from the camps, and they and their children formed much of the population of the country. So obviously the memory and the trauma of that event is still very deeply embedded in the country. But it is a country that has many other problems, and I think that Burg somewhat exaggerates the centrality of the Holocaust and also puts it mainly as an obsession of the Jews. And what has happened in Israel, and I'll just tell you one story to give an example, is that this obsession has become part of the conflict that is at the center of Israel's identity, and that's the conflict between the Israelis, Jewish Israelis, and the Palestinians. The story is of a group of Palestinian students, or rather Israeli Arabs, who were visiting a Holocaust museum in Israel, and they were shown a model of Treblinka. And as they looked at the model of this extermination camp, one of them said, well, this is not as bad as what the Israelis are doing to us now, because at least in Treblinka, the Jews were killed right away, and they are killing us every day. And so the Holocaust has become a sort of subtext of the actual real problem of what is happening now in Israel, and that real problem is an unresolved conflict. The roots of that conflict predate the Holocaust. They go back to the beginning of Zionism, and it continues long after the end of the Holocaust, with the Holocaust really playing just the role of an example, a bad example, but merely an example and not the actual issue that most Israelis and most Palestinians are concerned with.
As you know, he also argues in his book that a nation of refugees, by its creation, by the fact of its creation, created another nation of refugees and as a rule, declined to accept that fact.
Exactly. You know, Zionism had two main slogans when it was established in the beginning of the previous century. One slogan was that one should give a people without a land without a people. That is, take the Jews from the diaspora where they had no land and give them the land of Israel where there were no people. Unfortunately, of course, there were people living there. The second was that one should not only take the Jews out of the diaspora, but take the diaspora out of the Jews. That is, make new people, create, normalize Jewish existence, create new people. Now, of course, one could not do that because if you took the diaspora out of the Jews, then they were left without any history. And what is Jewish identity without history? And so Zionism, long before the Holocaust, faced these two main problems. One was, how do you create a new identity without giving up your history? And the second, how do you create a nation in a land in which there are already people? And so the main conflict is a conflict about identity and about land. The Holocaust came later, and the Holocaust destroyed much of the Jewish people. It did give Israel a new legitimization for the Zionist movement. But the main issue predated the Holocaust, and it's still at the core of what is happening now in Israel and between Israelis and Palestinians.
This book caused an uproar when it was published in Israel, and I suspect it will do the same in this country, too, among many American Jews. Do you think that uproar is justified?
Well, I don't know, because I don't think that what Burg says is outrageous. I don't think that he is fundamentally wrong. There is obviously a real preoccupation with the Holocaust. Some of it has negative manifestations, and some of it does not. We have to remember, for instance, that much of the discourse we have now about genocide is a result of the beginning of speaking about the Holocaust, which goes back only to the 1980s. If you were to read history books, books about World War II in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, you would not find the term Holocaust or genocide of the Jews in the index. It was not part of that history. That has moved into the center of our understanding of what the 20th century was, precisely because we began to see the link between the Holocaust and other genocides. And what Burg says, rightly, is that the world should focus on genocides that are occurring right now. The problem is that his view of Israel's manifest destiny, of Israel being a light unto the nations, is that Israel should be involved in somewhat helping with other crimes against humanity around the world. That would be very good. But Israel right now is, in fact, committing crimes against people that it is occupying at this very moment. And so what it has to do, first of all, is make peace in its own house, and then it could go back to the manifest destiny as described in Burg's book.
Omer Bartov is in Cambridge. I'm sitting across the table from Avraham Burg, who's, I think, bitterly disappointed you said he was not outrageous. But let's bring him into the conversation.
Omer, shalom.
Shalom.
I'm quite reluctant to argue with Omer. He is too educated, too smart, and too knowledgeable for my limited skills. But nonetheless, I don't understand how you can argue against me that my argument, it's an overstatement that Israel is over-obsessed by it, and in a minute you cross the border and you say the entire Middle East is obsessed by it. But nonetheless, leaving this aside, I will say two things. One is about the nature of polemics, and the other one is about what I think you think is the most important or crucial issue in Israel and what I think is. Polemic for me, is very important, not only being a Jewish second nature, but because I think it's a tool of creation. If I agree with you and you agree with me and all of us persuade Neil, it becomes a very boring world and nothing new is born between us. Only if we have kind of polemic and disagreement and controversy, some kind of Hegelian offspring is born between us. And therefore, it's very important.
Synthesis, yes.
Yeah. I feel that, Omer, you believe that the primary sin, if I can say, or the remedy for so many of Israeli maladies is the occupation, and therefore we must put an end to the occupation in the occupied territories. I'm not very far from you, maybe a bit to your left, to say I fully buy into it, I'm fully committed to it, and very active there, but my sentiment that for many years I thought, yes, let's put an end to this occupation, that will put an end to all of our problems, is not there anymore. I believe we cannot mentally and psychologically depart from the West Bank because of an earlier trauma. And the earlier trauma is the trauma of the Holocaust and 2,000 years, of course, before the Holocaust. And before we address this wound, this open bleeding wound, and we address the trauma and release a little bit our obsessive grip of these horrors we know and give a chance to a new trust and a new environmental confidence, it will be impossible to go for the solution you want.
Should I respond?
Yes.
No.
Or you could just concede.
I could concede. Look, I mean, the occupation that we are talking about did not come about in 1948. It came about in 1967. And it had certain messianic elements to it, which became very clear in Israel right after 1997, when many people in Israel, some of whom one would never have expected it from, spoke about this as being the third temple, the first two temples having been destroyed in antiquity. This was Israel's third temple. Israel came into its own. So this kind of messianic speech came in long after the Holocaust. What resulted in that, and unfortunately resulted on both sides, was the extremists took over. Both the Jewish extremists, who are a minority in Israel and yet have it in an iron grip, and the extremists on the Palestinian side.
They didn't take over. They kidnapped and abducted both societies.
Kidnapped and abducted both societies.
That's right.
And Israeli and Palestinian leadership has failed miserably over those years to confront that issue. Now, where I differ with Avum is on one issue. What I say is that the Holocaust has become a kind of rhetorical tool. People use it all the time. Just a few days ago, when settlers were being evicted from parts of Hebron, they were shouting at the soldiers, Nazis. They were trying to use this rhetorical tool. But ultimately, it's not about that. This is not the actual issue. If one could resolve the real issue, this rhetorical tool will go to where it belongs, and people would be able to think and to study that period in history as a period in history and not as an ever-present event that one cannot somehow overcome. And what I fear about Burke's book, and this is my only real difficulty with it, is that it takes us away from the central issue. It takes us to another place. Instead of talking about what we have to talk about, which is to make both Israelis and Palestinians less fearful of dividing that country and living side by side with the border in between, we talk about overcoming past traumas. Overcoming those traumas is possible only if you normalize the present, not if you normalize the past.
And before you get into it, because we have to move on, I will just summarize that. He would say that you can't possibly do that until you can de-traumatize some of the past. But in any case, let us thank Omer Batov for his presence with us today. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much.
You.
And Omer Batov, professor of European history at Brown University, with us today from a studio at MIT in Cambridge. And let's get Tanya on the line. Tanya with us from Walnut Creek in California.
Hi.
Hi, Tanya. Go ahead, please.
Oh, I was just calling to say that I'm happy to hear that there's somebody kind of coming out with this point of view now. I've been thinking this for a long time, and I grew up in a family with a Holocaust survivor. My dad is a Holocaust survivor. And while we grew up, you know, just really in awe of what he survived and all that had happened, the stories that we heard were endless in our lives. And as children, we were pretty much traumatized by it. They talked about it from a very early age, my parents. And I think what your guest has said hits the nail on the head, and that is that when you are constantly reviewing the horrors of the past, you can't go forward in trust. And so in Israel and Palestine, the Palestinians also, when you raise your children constantly speaking of the wrongs that were done to you and the horrors and the awfulness, you don't leave them much room to look for hope and promise. That's kind of my point of view.
Tanya, thank you for that. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tanya.
We're talking with Avraham Burg about his new book, The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get, this is Reggie. Reggie with us from Cincinnati.
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're on the air, Reggie. Yeah. Go ahead, please.
I kind of appreciate the Jewish remembrance of their history, especially of the Holocaust, especially as an African-American and an African-American activist and Afrocentrist. And I'm constantly, when I give speeches or whatever to different groups, our people, the African-American people, kind of suffer from a shameness about our enslavement period, which, in essence, which because we're ashamed of that period and we're ashamed of the inferiority complex that came from that period due to the seasoning process, we tend not to want to remember our past, and we don't have the cohesiveness that the Jewish people have. And I think part of their cohesiveness is attributed to that Holocaust period.
Avraham
Burg? Can the speaker...
We're just asking him to address that, if you would. Yeah, hang on.
Reggie, thank you very much for your question. I listened both to yours and Tanya's remarks or exchange with us. And yes, I have a feeling that from the role of my people in the last couple of years is a bit off, is a bit miss. We deal too much on the instrumental side of the memory, as Omer spoke and I spoke, and less about the content, the real meaning of it. And I'm very happy to talk to you about it. You know, I was very moved when President-elect Obama was elected, because everybody around the world spoke about, wow, the slavery is over, which means here you take a long memory, an open wound, and you deal with it with a real and sincere, very containing word, which is, it's not about I insult you the way you insulted me, but let's together overcome the trauma. And for me, the never again that we so much use, it's not never again for Jews. It's not never again for Jews only. It's not never again, let's have the thickest walls around us and the deepest shelter above us. For me, never again is never again for anybody who needs me. Never again is my voice as a victim of the yesterday's victim to prevent any future victimization of anybody around the world. And it's my role with you, Reggie, and Tanya, and anybody else who's a partner to our coalition, is to raise the voice and wake up the indifferent nations, because it was indifference that eventually enabled the atrocities to happen, not just the bad people who did it.
Reggie, thanks very much. We just have a minute with you left, and I can't leave you without asking. There is a vacuum of power at the moment in Israel. There's a vacuum of power on the Palestinian side as well, or a competition for power on the Palestinian side. What do you think is going to happen in the next 6 months? Is there going to be anybody to negotiate with on either side?
It a lot depends on the West and the president of the White House. I mean, the last 8 years were not years of dialogue in the world, were years of shooting and cowboy policies around the world. And whatever was allowed by the White House to be done around the world was done around the world. Only if we'll have a president who put a lot of pressures on the sides, alongside with Europe, we should not have two world policies, but the world community saying, listen, you locking your horns, Israeli and Palestinians, let us help you to get away from this catch-22 for the betterment of both societies. We'll help you to negotiate, to bridge, to mediate, to overcome the fears and the traumas. And the way to do it is the way of the New World rhetoric. Address the fears and the traumas of the other and only then go for the politics of it.
Avram Burg, thank you very
much.
Thank
you very
much,
Neil.
Former Speaker of the Israeli Knesset, the author of The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes, joined us here today in Studio 3A. Up next, a new report on the prevention of genocide. So what's new? Former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, former Secretary of Defense William Cohen will join us. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.